This is Talk of Asian Marketing with a special emphasis on localized Chinese consumer behavior. Welcome to Talk of Asian Marketing. And today we have a very interesting topic, a topic that a lot of people may be attracted to, especially with the rise of the Chinese economy. We're going to be talking about Chinese, the language that is. And today we have a special guest, Dr. Robert Reynolds from Jinan University, which is out in Puri, which is very central Taiwan. And he's in the foreign language department there at Jinan University. Robert, want to say hello to everybody?
Hi. Okay. How's it going?
That's everybody, the two of us. And of course, as always, we have Dr. James Stanworth from Tsinghua University of Education, the Business Administration Department. And I know James is very interested in this topic because he's been doing a lot of Chinese studying lately. So James, what's your take on this and how are you feeling?
I'm feeling really good and really excited to have Robert with us because, well, Robert's way up in the clouds, far away from us all in terms of his knowledge and ability with the complex Chinese language. So I'm really looking forward to getting some nice insights today.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I've adjusted to the English language yet, so you've all beaten me on this. Okay, I want to begin just to set things off because I want to really jump into get Robert's input on all of this. But I want to start with a story, and Robert, you know, react anytime you want to because you and I kind of did this story before on the train. Remember that day we were on the train coming back to Taichung one time?
Yeah, right.
Well, it began with an argument inside my family, and it went something like this. We had a bag of these orange things on the table, and in Chinese, they're called jizi, and I automatically assumed that they're oranges. But my daughter said, when I asked for an orange, she said, no, these are not oranges. These are tangerines. And I said, no, wait a minute. No, these are oranges. And she said, no, an orange is a liu ding, and a tangerine is a jizi, at which I became very confused. We had a big argument. We laid bets. And I think I lost, but because I'm the father, I forced them all to admit their the error of their ways. Now, let me just fill it in for a second, because the point of the story is this. It seems that from a perspective of just looking at the word orange, things should be simple, right? Because orange is this orange you eat, but it's also the orange color. Now, in Chinese, the word for orange color is also uses the exact same word orange, jizi se, right, color. And so orange color, I just thought an orange color is orange, and so an orange must be an orange. So, Robert, what am I doing wrong?
Well, you're making bets with your children first. but there's a lot of strange problems that can come up, especially when we're talking, of course, about things like fruit or food that people are not particularly aware of. But there's other things there's hidden problems in here that are very interesting, and they lay traps for people who are trying to sell things in English versus sell things in Chinese. Mm. So, for example, what do you call... this is another interesting one that I had to go to the dictionary to. When you, I don't know if I should give this example. I'll give it anyway. When you go into the Chinese restroom at the train station, there is a sign above the urinal which says, do not throw, in English, okay? And it says, do not throw rubbish or snipes in the urinal.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that sign, snipes, yeah.
And so I had to... Now, James is laughing because James knows what it is, right?
Mm.
Do you know what a snipe is?
Well, a snipe for me is a nasty comment.
Ah, oh, interesting. Well, I don't know where this comes from then, but I looked it up in a dictionary and said it was British for a cigarette butt.
Mm. Oh, geez, that must be, you must have a dictionary from the 40s, I think. I, to be honest, I've never, ever, ever heard that. I wonder if it's maybe the in UK we do have some differences by region. So it may be a very, very local word for a cigarette butt. That's one explanation. The other one is that it's very old English. That might be often dictionaries give the very old English as well. But I've learned something new today about English.
And so this is, I mean, you know, their intent was very clear. Don't throw cigarette butts into the urinal, right? But they, you know, the effect on me was I threw my cigarette butt in the urinal and ran off to get my dictionary. And so this is the sort of, this is, you know, there are traps that go in both directions, I think, for this thing. The problem for Clyde's example has, I think, practical implications for selling things. You tell them, I'm sending you a crate of oranges, and they look up the word orange, and if their dictionary says Liu Ding, and that's it, and they look and they get a crate full of tangerines, they're going to return it. And then, and then what? Right? And they're not going to buy things from you again. So the dictionary equivalences are very, you know, have very far-reaching effects on commerce, on international commerce. And some of these things are weird, right? We don't know what some of these things are. But this is, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg, really, in terms of you want to give it. You have a name, and in English, then you call it this, and so you're selling some sort of fruit that's technically made from some sort of candy that's technically made from tangerine juice, but you sell it as, you know, orange juice candy.
Yeah.
And then the Chinese writer is going to come up and he's going to call it, you know, Liu Ding candy.
Yeah. Right.
Right, and then you're going to get sued by the Consumer Protection Agency because the Chinese feel these are very different fruits.
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, the thing that got me was that it seemed like something that was so obvious. I mean, we had been going on for years thinking everyone thought they knew, but the thing everybody knew were different things, and we just never, you know, no one ever said, excuse me, you're saying the wrong thing. I bet you're wrong, you know?
Right. Yeah, this is a very... like I said, fruits are very tricky things. Fruits especially. So, and you know, it's not unified. So they have this very nice fruit in Taiwan, which is called a yangtao. And I look it up in a dictionary, and lo and behold, I get carambola.
Yes,
carambola, but everyone here calls it a star fruit.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
because of the shape of the fruit, which is a very odd shape. And so this is doubly tricky. But now I see newer dictionaries, which apparently have been edited by people who have, you know, lived in this environment, and they give the word star fruit.
Okay.
So this is, you know, I mean, the first problem is trying to establish some sort of equivalence in, you know, in the two languages. And for things like yangtao, which, or I don't know what to call it now anymore, we don't have it in the States, right?
Yeah, I never saw it. James, do you have a star fruit in the UK?
It was a great example. It really resonated with me, actually, because it wasn't that long ago that someone told me the formal name for star fruit, just like you've mentioned there, Robert. And it was the first time I'd heard it, and I was thinking, geez, what fruit have I not eaten? It's really intriguing. And then we figured it out. It was star fruit, and I thought, oh, well, yeah, I've seen that in plenty of our hypermarkets in the UK. So that really... kind of resonated with me. And I think that for me, I don't know how true it is, but I have a real sense in the Chinese English sort of languages that one thing I noticed, I learned a little bit of French, and one thing that I noticed was that French is great for slang. It's really fantastic for hundreds of different ways to curse and a real rich vocabulary for slang. But English always seemed to be really good for its range of description and words having so many slightly different meanings. And my students always seem to struggle with the fact that English has this huge vocabulary range and each word means something very subtly different. And I'm wondering how that sort of compares to Chinese as a language.
Ah, well, this is a serious problem, but, you know, I'm afraid it would kind of take us pretty far product naming in Chinese. If we can pull this back a little bit to, you know, the effects of this sort of some of these problems for selling something you've got in English, you've got a name in English, and you want to give it a name in Chinese. There's big problems then with getting out a dictionary.
Yeah.
Right? The dictionary is not always going to help you. It's going to give you, very often, how can I describe this? When I teach a translation class, I have to be very careful to explain to the students that, you know, not all dictionaries are created equal. There are dictionaries that are created basically for just telling people what the heck does it mean. And these are usually not good for translation. What you want is a dictionary that gives you the translation equivalent. Okay.
When you say equivalent, you mean exactly the same meaning?
You want the word in Chinese that's used for that word in English. So let's say that you look up the word dog in an English-Chinese dictionary. And what you get could be, it's not common, but sometimes you do get it. What you could get is that it gives you the English word dog, and the Chinese says a meat-eating quadruped. Right? You know? And so you open a store that says Joe's Meat-Eating Quadrupeds. And the customers are profoundly confused by this, you know, and they avoid it like the plague because it could be lions or tigers or bears. Oh, my. And so this is a case where the dictionary gave you the meaning. It didn't give you the translation equivalent, which is go.
Mm.
You understand the problem? There are many, many cases where this sort of thing happens. It works the other way. In Chinese English dictionaries. So these things are very tricky. And using a dictionary just to get this meaning is not always the best way to go. And this is where, of course, it helps to have native speakers who are working for you. But then we get to the problem of this is just physical objects, right? Physical objects that, you know, in theory have some sort of it would seem like they have an equivalent. Actually, even things that are physical objects like fruit don't always have an English equivalent or a Chinese equivalent, right? But when you get to other things that you want to, for example, Joe's Eatery, okay? You own a string of restaurants that are called Joe's Eatery, and you look up eatery in the Chinese dictionary. What's it going to say? It's going to say something like restaurant, right? And so your translation is then going to say Joe's Restaurant. But you spend a lot of time and money working with people, and they decided that Joe's Restaurant sucks in English. And so that's why they got you Joe's Eatery, right? And so how do you, you know, it's just not going to... The time and energy that you spent choosing a name for your company is not going to be reflected when you just pick something out of a dictionary.
Yeah, that's a good point. So you want to, I think one of the things we can see in some of the examples we have is this attempt to try to match some kind of meaning. But then we see that, you know, so really we come down to this idea that you can maybe directly translate it somehow. And what you're saying is that's just really, really hard.
Right? It's impossible, basically.
Impossible.
It's actually impossible to... you can do it directly in certain ways that are not really linguistic. So, for example, what's IBM in Chinese? And the answer is it's IBM.
Mm-hmm.
Right. What's 7-Eleven in Chinese? And it's 7-Eleven. Mm. Right? I mean, they actually say it in English.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's often shortened, isn't it, to say 7.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, that there you've just leaped over. They actually use the foreign language name, right? Mm-hmm. So letters, for example, letters are going to, you know, are going to carry for IBM, because they have such huge product recognition, they can get away with this. For other things, it doesn't seem to work as well. So, for example, the NBA, the National Basketball Association in America. They're a big marketing thing in Taiwan because everyone is really into American basketball. But they never use the name NBA. No, instead they say Zhilan, which means professional basketball. And so that, you know, it's not always something that you can actually choose to have your initials go over in the language. Will it be accepted, right? Will it stick? Right?
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit more in the second part of the show about some of this, but I think it's really hard. Even today, or just a couple of days ago, I asked my students who are, by the way, marketing majors at a university, a major university in Taiwan, and no one could tell me what IBM makes.
God.
Well, I can't, now that they've been making computers,
now we're not
sure
what
they make either.
But I mean, literally, because I mean, they haven't been in that kind of situation for a long time where they're that visible anymore, and that you don't see their machines, you know, at that level of a college kid's that much either. So I think it's really hard.
And a really interesting observation on branding and brand awareness. Actually, it's an interesting case.
Yeah, I think it's very risky, Robert, because you know you take those initials, and then they're just so easy, in my opinion, to drop off the map. You know, just suddenly nobody remembers what they are anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yes, if it doesn't have a very powerful brand sort of support strategy, yes, it just becomes nebulous.
And another funny thing is that people kind of convert these, just like James was saying, you know, people change 7-Eleven to be 7. So even though you keep them what they were in their source, the brand name from the original English, people still can distort it. For example, a lot of my students, I hear that they don't call YouTube YouTube, they call it YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, they're but the thing is that the pronunciation will never be exactly the same. The Japanese don't, you know, they're infamous for this.
Right.
So you go get a sandwich in Japan and you have to ask for the sandwichi. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So the pikniku.
Well, pikniku is okay, but, you know, what's a negudai? It's a neck. And so, you know, I mean, you know, this is the Japanese really use this thing of the phonetic equivalents. And I mean, it's so built into their system. They actually have a different alphabet that they use specifically for foreign words.
Right. Now, what about in Chinese, Robert? Because there is this, Wailai, right? These outside words that we import in, but there's not a separate system for them like there is in Japanese, is there?
No, there's not. They've tried to standardize the syllables, it gets really complicated because we have to talk about Chinese writing, right? Chinese writing is not written alphabetically. It's written in characters. And these characters, basically, they're, you know, commonly used. The standard ones in the newspaper, they're about 800, right? But if you look in the dictionaries, you can find dictionaries that will list over 60,000 of them.
Over 60,000.
And this, of course, is characters that include, you know, characters that are 3,000 years old, characters that are actually don't have any pronunciation. They're magical incantations that Taoists use to drive off the evil spirits. And there are, you know, things like the weird forms that they used to engrave on oracle bones when they were trying to divine the future. So it's full of, it's everything, right? 60,000 is no one knows 60,000 characters. No one uses 60,000 characters. 800 is, however, very reasonable. It's very standard that people would know. If you're literate, you know at least 800 characters. And so the problem is that many
literate.
The problem is that many of these characters are pronounced in very similar ways, right? Their pronunciation is actually very, very similar. And so you have a choice of more than one character when you're going to represent a sound from a foreign language in Chinese. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, so you have the characters are numerous, but the sounds are few.
And so there's been an attempt in mainland China to standardize the characters that are used for foreign sounds. That's the closest they've done to this. And it's, you know, it's pretty much a failure. Why is it a failure? This is very interesting. Because, you see, Chinese characters, they often encode meanings. And so I don't, you know, unless you've actually seen a character, I don't really, you know, it's hard for me to explain it.
Well, we can look at some of the pictures, Robert. Like picture number one would probably be the best example, since it's also one of the most successful transfers of a brand name. So if you scroll down on the web page, picture number one is the Coke picture.
Right. Okay. So the Coca-Cola. This is, you know, in the first, this is, of course, brilliant. And this was actually done, we know who did this. It was a Chinese guy who later became a very famous writer and painter. And apparently he entered Coca-Cola had a contest in Shanghai that said, you know, give us a Chinese name for our drink. And he entered the contest and he won something like 20 pounds.
I think without a doubt, this has got to be the best example
ever. This is the sale
ever.
Of the century.
Yeah, this is just it. This not only works in Chinese and works in English and works phonetically and is just so perfect.
Yes, but why is it working so perfectly in Chinese? Let's look at the four characters here, right? So there's one, two, three, four, okay? And of those, you'll notice that the first three, they look a little bit similar, right? There's a square. Do you see a square?
Yes.
And then there's something wrapped around it, and then there's a bigger square. Then there's another square wrapped around it again, right? The square means mouth, right? And so this is something you put in your mouth.
Perfect.
You get it? Right? So this is already, there's a meaning here that, you know, people makes people happy, right? That they can guess what it is, right? The way this works is a little bit unclear to me. I think that this came as a piece. That is to say, he just invented the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, because there are colas, right?
Right.
It's not just Coca-Cola, there are colas.
There's all different kinds.
So, Kele, the last two characters, have now come to be the generic name for all colas.
This is so great. Yeah, so there was probably no intention, but it's just phonetically it comes out that the N sounds like cola.
Uh-huh. Oh, no, it's perfectly on purpose.
Yeah, so that...
He made it on purpose.
So anyone who's making colas can then adopt that, just like back in the U.S. or the U.K., where you also adopt the generic form of cola.
Right, that's right. I mean, this is a problem, I think, a little bit for the Coca-Cola company. They would like to have copyrighted the whole thing. Part of it has been stolen. But the Coca-Cola then gets, you know, it's still a phrase, right? It's a special kind of cola. Now, Coco means tasty. Mm. Cola means something that's pleasant. So tasty and pleasant. And there you go.
These characters are very commonly used in everyday communication also.
They're short. If you count how complicated a Chinese character is, you count by what are called pen strokes. And so the mouth character takes three. It's almost as simple as you can get,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's super easy to write. The meaning is very pleasant, and the sound is just about as close as you could get to the sound of Coca-Cola in Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, perfect. This is perfect. This one works perfectly. If we look at the next one, Skippy, this is a different story, right? Unfortunately,
I should just point out Skippy is like a peanut butter, isn't it?
That's right. That's peanut butter. Okay, and so they've gone strictly for the phonetics,
strictly for the sound of the Skippy.
Skippy. That's right. Mm-hmm. There's nothing in there. So Coca-Cola tells you that this is something to eat,
right?
And it's something tasty. And GB, the words have meanings, right? The G, the first
G one is like good fortune or something.
Right. Right. It's auspicious,
mm-hmm.
and B means compare. Compared to, right? And so, compared to other anything else, you could be doing better. You could be doing worse, right? So this is going to be, this is an auspicious thing. But what is it, right?
Right. So what inside their name, inside the brand name, there's nothing telling you what it is, which reminds me, of the classic marketing story where there was a company trying to market dehydrated milk, right? So milk powder in Africa.
Right.
And mm-hmm. the place they were marketing it was, there was some traditional beliefs that at night monsters come and eat children. And they couldn't figure out why their milk wouldn't sell. And mm-hmm. because they had pictures of babies on it. So the classic question is, how do you package it and make the meaning clear? In this case, putting babies on the package only told people it was, baby stolen at night and put inside cans.
Whoa. Very unpleasant. But there's another problem with the Skippy here, which is that you see how Skippy starts with SK?
Yes.
Chinese doesn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no Chinese doesn't have words that start with SK. Never. It's not there. So this G is an attempt to get the Skippy, the first part of it, but they'll never get it, right? And so this is where it gets really tricky, right? You could choose G, you could choose Chi, you could choose Xi, you could choose all kinds of, there are all kinds of choices, but none of them work because the sound doesn't exist in Chinese.
Yeah, right? I was kind of wondering why they didn't go with a Xi sound, because it seemed much closer, Xi-bi, but then...
The G is, of course, auspicious, mm-hmm. so they like this, right? She sometimes has the, to me, there's a danger that you might think it means something like diarrhea.
Mm.
And then this would
on diarrhea.
Right? And so this is, this is, the people invent insults for this. A famous example of this is Windows XP. Now, Windows XP in Chinese, the way that this is called now by people at least who are hostile to Microsoft, the X is in Chinese, they sometimes say ca, 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 ca means to mark something with an X, right? So you mark the box with an X, you mark the tally with an X. If you're illiterate, you mark your name with an X. Hua ta means to make that X mark. And then P in Chinese, if you pronounce it in the correct tone, means buttocks. Right? And ta is homophonous with the word for wipe. So when they call XP tapi, you see that they're very hostile to it. And unfortunately for Microsoft, I don't think there's anything they can do about it.
No, because it fits so perfect.
Yeah, it fits perfectly. That's right.
Because the X is a normal character people recognize in Taiwan, and it's always called ta-ta-ta.
Right, yeah. That's right. And so it's very natural to say Tapi.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but then it's very negative for Microsoft, I think.
Now, just to make that clear for anybody who missed it, so Tapi means then to wipe your ass.
That's right. That's correct. Microsoft, wipe your ass. Right.
So that's a great example.
I paid 5,000 NT dollars for Microsoft to wipe my ass. Oh, I don't like that.
For some toilet paper.
Can you please edit this afterwards?
But Robert, have they made it? I haven't seen any of the packaging that has a Chinese name for it. I always just see it as XP.
Microsoft never does the Chinese translations. They always stick to their English ones. So the only thing is that sometimes Windows gets translated as Shichuang.
Mm-hmm.
This is a neologism that has been adopted for programmers who use, you know, software Windows on their monitors.
Yeah, unless I'm wrong, I thought that had already come out with earlier versions of Unix, though. I thought that was already around with Unix ex-Windows versions.
No, actually, Unix is kind of a latecomer to Chinese.
Mm.
In fact, most of the computer stuff was done, many of the computer names were first done in Taiwan. And then finally, when mainland China started, you know, getting into this thing, they actually redid a number of the key technical terms. So this is a big, big problem right now.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, you know, it's very ununified. Unlike basic things like, say, physics, chemistry, mathematics, this terminology, because it was, you know, introduced in China in the 19th century. And so the mainland China and Taiwan still have the same terms.
That's one thing that surprises me. When I do go to China and I go visit universities, I notice a lot of the department names and the things they're doing inside the departments, the names are exactly the same as they are here.
That's right. That's right. Some of them are also because they're borrowed from Japanese, but mm-hmm. some of them were, you know, originally they were transmitted to China in the 19th century in various ways, or even earlier. And so they get to keep the same thing. But newer concepts, there's much more difference, and computer is one example of that. But let's take a look at some of these other things. This is very... So Skippy has, you know, is definitely a weaker product name than Coca-Cola. Why is it weaker? Number one, it doesn't transmit the meaning of what the product is. Number two, its GB is not by itself a Chinese phrase. It's just two separate syllables that sound okay, but they don't have a meaning within themselves.
Nobody would ever say that in another context.
No, there's no other context for that to happen, right? Now we go up to Colgate. Colgate...
Robert, I just want to dive in for a minute because you mentioned the idea of phrases. And I just wanted to explore that idea because clearly in English, if you start to put words together,
mm-hmm.
then it sort of you can't put random words together. But somehow it's possible in Chinese.
No, we do this in English, but we do it at a word level. Think of the names of various kinds of medication. Think of Viagra. Viagra is an invented word. Right,
and they
spent lots and lots of money inventing this word. Right.
Yeah.
So this is a very
sort of late 90s, early 2000 kind of way of working. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, medications. This is something that's very common. Medications are you know, they choose so Valium, right? This is actually they did this back in the 60s, right? Thorazine, right? Some of these have a scientific basis, but Valium, no. That was that's a marketing name. And this is done by marketing people.
These are syllable levels, right?
This is done at syllable level.
Yeah, so
right?
We take the syllables, put them together, and we get a new fancy word.
That's right. So Skippy is almost, the GB is almost at the syllable level, whereas Coca-Cola is clearly at a phrase level. Kuko is a word, and it belongs to itself, and kele is another word, and it belongs to itself. And yet we know that now kola also stands for cola. So it's the tasty cola. You see? And so the meaning comes out in a very sharp way. You don't have to guess this at all.
Robert, I'm just wondering whether it would be interesting just to talk for a minute about Tesco, Ter Eco, and Carrefour.
Right, yeah. Carrefour, that's right. So this is all at the, how can I say it? It's at that word level. It's at Carrefour is again. But Chinese has this other tendency, which is that so the Chinese also has this tendency to, it looks for happy words that are put together in a happy way. And so, for example, the Carrefour is Jialefu, and it has this feeling of it's the list of the happy words, right? And so you're wishing someone good luck. When you wish someone good luck, you say, good fortune and long life, right? Mm-hmm. And then it has the, although it's treated as if it were simply sound, but it has the effect of wishing someone, happy shopping or something like that, right? It's a place that you wouldn't mind going because, good things will happen to you there, right? So this is an interesting way of approaching it. It's often done with store names. I've noticed this.
So right? Carrefour has created that really positive feeling for people going there for their home and for good fortune and happiness, whereas Tesco seem to have gone a different way, or am I mistaken?
I don't know what the characters for Tesco are. I don't know what the characters for Tesco are. What do they call it in Chinese? Yes.
Tesco, we can translate the Tesco to be especially easy for shopping.
Okay, so Tesco, Taiwan... I see.
Especially easy for shopping.
Right. Te-i-go. Oh, now they've made it into a sentence.
Right? Just like Jialefu is for the family to happily shop.
No shopping.
Happily.
No, there's no shopping in the Jialefu, right?
No. Fortune, yeah, right.
Right. Jia is actually, right. It's more like the, what is it they write on the chopsticks all the time? So
long life.
Fulu. So, right? On chopsticks, they write happy phrases, too. They do. They write, this is a, long life, good appetite, good fortune, make lots of money. And they put this on the chopsticks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's called looking for good luck. And so this is the Jialefu sort of feeling for me. But to you go, this is a sentence. It's especially easy to buy stuff here, right? So this is yet another approach. If we look at the Colgate, Colgate is again a string gaoluchia, and this of course is way off from what the English pronunciation would be, but it has some similarity, right? It has the CO, it has an L, and the G, they've got the jie, and that's it. I'm wondering, Stephen, the gaoluchia, that jie, if you say it in Taiwanese, how do you say it?
Jie.
Jie bai de jie. How do you say that?
Green.
How do you say that in China,
Taiwanese?
In
difficult because the Minanhua is a little bit different from the Mandarin.
Right. What I'm wondering is, does it end with a T in the Minanhua? Does Jie Bai?
A little bit similar. Yeah.
It ends with a T. Okay. Three. So many of these. many of these names, the characters they've chosen, actually don't reflect Mandarin, which is the national language that everyone mm-hmm. speaks. They reflect dialect pronunciations. This is very common in Hong Kong. And so this is one reason that Hong Kong product names are totally different from what they are in Taiwan. Because if you yeah. pronounce them in the Cantonese dialect, some of these things that sound so nice in Mandarin suddenly become horribly obscene. mm-hmm. Right? So this is a big problem, actually. And, you know, I mean, you have to look at your market, right? Taiwan, the most common local dialect is called the Minnan dialect. And people often, you know, look at this and they think about it in the Minnan dialect. And they, you know, they want lucky words or nice sounding words. They do this with numbers, right? So yes. The old school I used to work at, it's the only address on the street. And yet the address is 168. Right? Why is the address yeah. one? Why does it doesn't start off with one, three? It's, you know, there's nothing up there, and you get to the top, and it's address 168. Why? Because it sounds like make money all the way.
Yes.
yeah. There are many yes. buildings that have this sort of thing, but that only works in the Minnan dialect, and so Minnan dialect influences words that people are choosing a lot, and so I think this Gaoluqie. Which is Colgate, is influenced by the dialect that's chosen. But it works in Mandarin in this way. Gao is high, Lu is to show, and Jie is clean, pure, right? So these are all things that you would like to have in a toothpaste, right? High mm-hmm. purity that lets you show your teeth.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really the key point. You use the Chinese characters, you cannot escape that they contain meaning.
That's right.
Yes.
That's
and exactly then you're right. also having the phonetic sound. But there's right. where things get complex, right? Because that phonetic sound in the Taiwanese dialect or in a different location in China may actually have a negative or derogatory connotation, yeah. even though the Chinese characters still remain the same.
Right, exactly. Now, there's you say that you can't escape meaning, and yet sometimes it looks like the meaning has almost escaped. For example, let's take a look at head and shoulders.
Yeah, Robert, this really puzzles me because I thought head and shoulders would be the perfect product to use a meaningful, you know, head and shoulders translation.
Yeah. It's very simple. They chose to do it this way. I mean, you know, you say it's perfect and they just the guy who introduced it, their local salesman said, let's just give it a foreign sounding name.
Mm-hmm.
And there you go. But you can break it down a little bit, okay? Heilun is, I mean, the fact that they chose Heilun is significant because Heilun is the way Chinese usually transliterate Helen.
Hmm.
Now
the name Helen, yeah.
Helen was a famous beauty, was she not?
Mm-hmm,
the face
true.
That launched 1,000 ships. So yeah. and people know this. People know this, even in China they know this. Heilun is the name of a famous beauty, right? So they've stuck that on there. Xian is the next word. Xian is usually used to mean immortals, that is to say mystical creatures that never die and live in some, you know, never-never land, some sort of, you know, Taoist paradise, right? And du means to cross over. And si has to do with, si is silk, right? And so mm-hmm. this is hair. This is often used for hair, right? So mm-hmm. it has a meaning in a very bizarre way. And this sort of thing often pops up. That is to say, even though it looks like it's a strictly transliteration. They've chosen characters that are gonna. You can force some meaning into it. Are you getting what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally. Yes. And that explains, you know, the Helen reference. You know, my kids, when we go shopping, I ask them, what do you see any meaning? And they're like, I don't see any meaning there.
Right. Yeah. But no, I think there's meaning in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But the main point is they're getting the phonetic sound very close to head and
they've
shoulders.
They've chosen the phonetic sound, but the characters are doing something. Originally, it might not have been these characters. This happens. They actually will change the characters to make it a more salubrious sort of meaning, to suggest a sort of meaning, right? Mm-hmm. Occasionally, they can't do this. So there's a picture. There's a product in here which you didn't pick up, mentholatum.
Yeah, I think we have that on the research show, actually. Yeah.
Okay. Well, mentholatum is they were unable to come up with characters that had. I mean, it's done. You know, it's done phonetically. I can't remember the exact characters.
Oh, I'll go out and look for it. Actually, I got Robitussin, mentholatum. I'll go find a picture and post it.
Well,
yeah,
mentholatum. Oh, okay. There you go. All right, and this doesn't.
Okay.
That doesn't mean anything to anyone. And no. So, what is this product called? It's called Xiaohusi.
Yes.
It's called the Little Nurse.
Because of the Little Nurse logo on it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A logo on it. And so, this is when people want to go buy mentholatum, they ask for, give me some of the Little Nurse.
Right.
I think they should immediately. I don't know if they've been stupid enough to not trademark the Little Nurse. If they haven't, then a Chinese company could come in and they could call their thing the Little Nurse Medicine, right? And then they've lost it. It's very interesting, though, right?
So people just pick that up on their own. And they call the product by the logo, and then the name doesn't really make much difference.
It's not just that they did it on their own. The Chinese name, they couldn't make head or tail of it.
So, Robert, that's an interesting point. That could actually be then something to think about, right? So you could actually go out of your way to make the Chinese characters phonetically match, but be on purpose, make no meaning, and then you're forced to go with the logo or something like that. How's that line up with our Quaker example, number six?
Quaker is very interesting, too. Quaker, of course, you know, this is I taught American literature, and, you know, the Quaker, there's really no good Chinese translation for it. It's a religious group. It's a religious group. So this picture of the man on the thing with the funny hat doesn't mean doodly squat to anyone here. I mean, it just doesn't mean anything, right? Who is this guy, you know, with the rosy cheeks, the long white hair, and the 18th century hat? It doesn't mean anything. It's certainly very recognizable. But they can't, you know, I mean, it's, you might as well, you know, have a Chinese product in America that has a picture of Chiang Kai-shek on it.
Yeah, right. I think some people get this face mixed up with the colonel from KFC, actually.
It doesn't do anything, right? But they translate using the words Quaker, and this makes me, this is interesting. First, the Gui is actually cinnamon. The word means cinnamon. G is, you know, a meaningless syllable that gets tacked onto a lot of transliterations because Chinese words cannot end in a G. So they add, when they have English words that end in a G, they add a G at the end of it. It's like Japanese. You know how Japanese syllables have to end in vowels. That's why sandwich becomes sandoichi. They have to end in vowels. Chinese words are pretty much like this as well. And so they add the gui ge, and the ge, the gui suggests that it's you know, it's edible. The ge suggests that it's foreign and it's short, it's easy to write. And then they stick, and actually the big thing that's on this picture you're showing here says simply oatmeal.
Yeah, so the product actually comes out really, really clear. It tells you exactly what it is right there.
That's right. It says in big Chinese letters, oatmeal, and then it has the English logo and the picture of the guy. And the Quaker, the transliteration of Quaker, is not visible in this picture.
No, they keep it pretty small, actually. It goes up underneath the logo, I think.
Right. So this is another...
Yeah.
That's interesting on the idea of the making the product itself really clear, oatmeal. Because one thing I've noticed, I don't know if it's connected, is when I go into the, say, a restaurant to order something, and sometimes I'm given an English menu, and it's literally, it looks like a transliteration, and it can be really unappetizing. You get offered things like crab's intestines or crab's eggs or these things that really look really unappetizing. I presume it's a literal translation, and it's...
You shouldn't presume this. I once went to a restaurant which had a... I wish I had made a copy of their menu. But featured very prominently on this menu was a dish that was labeled as fried crap in brown sauce. Mm-hmm. And so my first guess was, aha, it's carp. Right? It's carp. But it turns out that this menu had been, over the years probably, the English translations and the Chinese names had been slowly disconnected. And fried crap and brown sauce was actually pig liver soup. So there's many great dangers in this, assuming that the menu is in any way, shape, or form accurate.
That's a great example. That's really good. That's like so. That's it's just so much. I mean, I think the best example foreigners first run into in Taiwan are movie titles, Roberts, because movie titles get all the different treatments, and then you get your sequels and things like that. But anyway, we're short on time. Let's move ahead with how about the Green Giant? You know, this is such a popular product in Taiwan. You know, Taiwan's a big producer of corn originally.
And look what they've done with this. It's trans. It says in the Chinese is really prominent up there. Right on, and right next to the English, Lu Ju Ren. It's right there, unlike the Guige, which is not there, right? And they have a picture of the green guy, and they have the Chinese words, green giant, right? So it really, this is really doable, right? Why is it doable? I can show you a picture of a green giant. Whereas I show you a picture of a Quaker and everyone says, who the hell is that?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the right? Chinese so has its own, it has a very clear meaning because kids all right. learn about giants, right?
Well, I mean, Juren is not an unusual word in Chinese. And you call him the green giant and people can make the connection that it has to do with vegetables. And there you go. Hello?
Yes.
Yes. And we have the world-class bicycle manufacturer called Giant.
Yeah, right. But they yeah. but that
so
is
it's very common in Taiwan to know what Giant is.
Yeah, right. I mean, Giant is, you know, a giant of industry, you know, a giant cultural figure, et cetera. So this is not hard, right? And but I mean, so they make the Chinese translation this is translation, right? This is not in any way, shape, or form phonetic. This is the most translated of all the things that we have here.
Yeah, this doesn't match the pronunciation at all.
At all. It has nothing to do with the pronunciation. It's strictly the meaning.
Mm-hmm. But I have a...
Go ahead, yes.
Okay. I have a question for Robert, but how about a giant to be gianter is
yes, that's very interesting.
Now that's the we should make it clear that's the bicycle company Giant, and
yes,
that is using the phonetic.
The Chinese is using the phonetic. That's right, but you see, it's a Chinese company.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting, isn't it? They chose the English name Giant, and then for the Chinese, they chose Gianta, right?
Yes.
In other words, a phonic translation of the English.
That's right. It's very interesting the Chinese did it this way. I think one reason that they did it this way is they want to give people although it's a Taiwan company, they want to give people the impression that it's a foreign company.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephen, I think Sony's very similar, right? Because when the founder of Sony came up with Sony's name, he made the name in English first.
Yes.
And then later they went on to the other names. And for the Chinese, can you tell us just real quick, just a minute, the situation with the Chinese for Sony? Because you were telling me that's changed recently.
Mm-hmm. They changed the Sony first to be Xin Li.
Xin Li.
New power.
New power. Literally, new power.
Uh-huh. Yes, but later they changed the name, Chinese name to be Sony.
So they went from characters that had their own meaning, but also had some of the sound, and now they go totally with the sound. Robert, right. Have you seen that case?
I just heard about this. Yeah, I recently heard about this. And I think this started in mainland China, I think. Mm-hmm. And mainland China is, I think, sort of, as I said, they've tried to standardize things. And so standardize, for example, the transliteration characters. And this could be, you know, an attempt to meet them halfway on this.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay.
I don't know.
Stephen, did you have any... do you know the reason why they made that change?
I think they just want to make the brand name short, more easy for the mainlanders to comprehend or to pronunciation.
Yeah, that could fit with what Robert's saying. There's more of a standardization on the pronunciation, yes. Emphasis. Yeah. Robert, sometimes we have products that actually have no or very little or very small Chinese on it, and that's the examples of 9, 10, and 11, where 9 is Neutrogena, and the right. Text is really small for any Chinese. Right. Raisins has none, but there, of course, the health information is in Chinese, and Gillette razors rarely have any Chinese on them.
They have Chinese names, though, and the Chinese name is, you know, auspicious, sharp, and special. Jili.
Jili, yeah.
And if you want to buy them, you got to tell them, I want the Jili to Dao Bian. You have to tell them that. So, I mean, but it's the Neutrogena. I have an explanation for this, right? This is a beauty product, a healthcare product, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So this is I suggested that it's very interesting. Giant, the Chinese company, Giant, chose to transliterate their name in Chinese, right? They gave it a meaningful name in English, and they gave it a transliteration in Chinese. And the suggestion is that this is a foreign product,
mm-hmm.
right? And so yes. There are certain cases where foreign products are higher prestige, and people will be attracted to them. Right now, Neutrogena is certainly, this is exactly what's going on. This is a high class beauty care product, and to label it as if it were made in Taiwan would reduce people's desire to buy it. Do you see what I mean?
Yes. In fact, we're going to talk a little bit more when we get into the research side of the show. So we're going to wrap this one up in a minute. But yeah, that's. You're getting the English right up top big, and the Chinese would be very small.
That's right. That's right. Now for the raisins, I think that this holds for all three of these things. These guys are basically, they want first. I think the manufacturer wants to, you know, doesn't want to hassle with translations, and so they just go ahead and use the original, or they're very fond of the layout that, you know, their packaging has, and the Chinese, adding Chinese often means you have to change the layout, right?
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm.
And so I see this for the fuels, for example, they have the clover, right? They have a clover shaped thing there. And, you know, I think they're very happy with this box, and it shows that it's raisins, and that's all they care about.
Right.
Right. As for the Gillette, I think they also think this is a cool package. Right, take a look at it. Right. Mach 3 Turbo, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, these last two, Robert, have the great advantage of you can really see and know what they are. Raisins are so common in Taiwan, right. Everyone knows what they are. Right. The razor's right out there through the plastic. You can see it.
Right, right. So this is it. But plus, I think they're concerned about preserving their packaging layout.
Yeah, well, that's always the balance between the standardization and the localization. So it's an interesting balance to strike.
But look how nicely Head and Shoulders managed it, right?
It's great. I mean, Head and Shoulders really captures the exact same feeling, I think, that their American packaging does.
Right.
Yeah, but I have a question for Robert. Don't you think Hairun Xiandu is too long for the Chinese?
I think that's an interesting question, and all I can say is it doesn't seem to have affected their sales, has it?
It does seem to sell well. It's in almost every kind of retail location. We should mention, you know, it's just one character longer than Coca-Cola, but Coca-Cola just seems to run off the tongue so easily.
Well, it's those are words. Those are words. The reason Stephen is feeling that Hailun Xiandu is too long is because it's not words.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Instead, it is five fundamentally unrelated characters, except the Hailun. It clearly goes together. Right? But then the Xiandu doesn't seem to be in any way connected to it. And there's no meaning to it. If I were to give you a list of... give you a four-word sentence, okay?
Yes.
Let's see. A four-word sentence might be something like, "Buy Joe's Burgers today," okay? And that's one. And now let's just mix it up a bit, okay? Burgers today, buy Joe. Which one is easier to remember?
Of course,
I even use the same words, right?
Right.
But I put them in a meaningful unit, and you remember them right away, right? Mm-hmm. You can remember this much more easily. So this is why people do these things. I don't know if you ever met anyone who is, you know, was pre-med. Now, pre-med, one thing you have to do is you have to memorize all 210 human bones, the Latin names of them, right? And so how do they do this? And the answer is they make up these rhymed songs, right? And so, you know, the ankle bones connect to the thigh bone, the thigh bones connect to the knee bone, et cetera, et cetera. They make up these rhymed passages that have two key things that help them remember. One is phonetic patterns, and the other is meaningful sentences. Right. Yes. And this is very, very powerful thing in advertising, right? And
it
we want to have it. But Hailun Xiandu seems to sort of defy this, and my analysis before was that I think it slowly means something. The si definitely has to do with hair, right? Hailun is definitely a beautiful woman. And then the Xiandu, you know, I mean, maybe Xiandu is, you know, her last name or something. So,
Helen, I don't know, that's reaching.
Helen Shendu's hair.
Yeah, but you know, the Head and Shoulders, the positioning of the Head and Shoulders is very, very clear in English.
That's right.
Yeah, that's the thing that really shocked me when I saw that, because in English it's so clear, and then it seems like it would be so easy just to take the literal meaning, Head and Shoulders, and use that in Chinese.
No. It wouldn't work at all. It wouldn't work at all. I mean, what would you say in Chinese? Would you say, Tou Hen Jian Bang? And then it's very weird, because it does. You're missing something here in the English. There's an English reference, right? Head and Shoulders.
Yes, to dandruff, yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's not just that. He stands head and shoulders above the competition.
Okay, right? Yes, there's multiple connotations, yes, yes.
There's a connotation in there that makes us feel that this is not a weird combination. But in Chinese, if you say Tou Hen Jian Bang, it doesn't mean that at all. Right? Mm-hmm. It's just listing parts of the anatomy, and people say, what's that?
Right, right. It would be like in English you say head and knee, right?
Right. Yeah, right. At knee, you know. I mean, what is this? It's even worse. Toe and jianbang. What does that have to do with hair? Right? It has nothing to do with hair. The si is in there to tell you it's hair.
So obviously this is something they probably ran into when they considered doing the translation. you couldn't get the meaning because it just doesn't have that meaning, even though the words could be the same.
That's right. That's right.
But actually, in English, it's just the same. I mean, head and shoulders are parts of the body, but it's that strong association with this as a anti-dandruff shampoo that, and the promotional approach and the advertising to showing people with a little bit of dandruff on the shoulders that's linked it all up. And
yeah, but it is. Robert's point is, it is also a phrase. Your head and shoulders above the rest.
Yeah, to me, it never occurred to me, actually, that hadn't. And I'm not sure that's brought out in their promotional strategy.
No, it's
all,
not.
Really.
I don't think that, Robert, I mean, this is your point, but I think what you're saying is, in English, it already is a phrase and it flows, even if you're not using it in the same way. But in Chinese, the words just never go together that way.
That's right. Those words don't go together in Chinese. They don't mean anything. You could say, here's what you could say in Chinese. You could say, shouling. Right, Ling. But this is a very classical phrase in the first place, and it has two. It has two meanings. A Shouling could be a leader, right? He's the head and the neck of the army,
right?
Right. So you could say he's the Shouling. But it has another. It has another meaning as well, which is when you decapitate someone, you take off the neck too. And so, Shouling in this case is, you know, rather horrifying, and we don't want to put that on our shampoo package because it implies you use it and your whole and your everything above the shoulders will fall off.
Right. Yeah, I mean it's a great example because it looks, you know, it's something on first glance it looks so easy, Robert, but then it's so hard. And I think that another great example is of the how this brand stuff works and what James is talking about, which is, you know, which comes first? You know, did we have the phrase works first, or is it the advertising that slowly got us used to the phrase? But I think no matter what, you've got to really be careful because once you get those things that are catchy, they really can stick with you. And so now we often think head and shoulders, like James saying, we think, well, this means anti-dandruff. But actually, I think it's already an existing terminology or phrase. And so finding that clean idea or that not dandruff idea in Chinese would be the goal, but I don't see how you could do that.
It's not something that people originally cared about.
Mm-hmm.
Let me be honest with you. I mean, I think that this is, you know, this is the anti-dandruff is a in a way it's a triumph of marketing. I've got dandruff, so what? So what?
Yeah. You know, I mean, it raises the profile and the awareness, and it becomes a sort of stigma, doesn't it? It's a cosmetic product,
and so you have to convince people either that that originally you looked ugly until you use it, or that this will make you look better. Mm-hmm. Right, it's one or the other, and so anti-dandruff stuff is, you know, it's working the other way. The commercials are all about, you know, the distressed woman notices she has dandruff and she loses her boyfriend.
Yep.
Right? It's a negative sort of thing in a way. And they're fighting, you know, people have this, you know, I think in Taiwan at least, the head and shoulders is more, the idea is more that it makes the hair, how can I say it? It's not, if you're fighting a negative thing, it's not that dandruff is really negative, though the commercials are working very hard on it.
Yeah, a lot of their commercials, I should probably put some in the page, are trying to emphasize that now.
Yeah, they're trying to do it, but I don't know if that's going to be successful. The idea is this: it makes your hair look pure, black, smooth, silky.
Well, that's the thing that rings the bell for local consumers.
The positioning of the another brand of the P&G, we call it Perth.
Right. Yeah, they do that too. Yeah. I mean, everyone does that, right? You know, they have the point is though that this removes those little white spots that distract people from noticing how pure, black, and silky your hair is.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
Right. This is what they want to do, right? And so they need to work on it this way. Right, it's not that dandruff is bad per se; it's that it's distracting people from the high quality of your hair.
Yes, you're getting right on code with what people, consumers here are really looking for, which is, in this case, the female market with the long black hair.
Right.
I think this is such an interesting point because it goes right back to looking at the actual product and then starting to actually think about the meaning and the values it has. And I remember talking to an advertising, the head of a little advertising agency in London, and he was talking about the problems of literal, like we've talked about, the sort of literal translation and the and then actually going for meanings for the consumer. And he was just talking about the Middle Eastern market and how challenging it was to move products from the West, from sort of France, from UK, and then arrange advertising campaigns and brand meanings for those in the Middle East. And so now we're trying to do that for the Far East and talk about that, and it's just got a whole different level of complexity. I mean, it's an unbelievable minefield, I think.
Yeah, well, hair products are especially a tricky thing, right? Hair products are a tricky thing. Why are they tricky? Because Chinese people don't come naturally blonde. They don't come naturally redheaded. They don't even come naturally brown-headed. They only come in one color, right? And so this is slowly, this has changed, right? This is a big change. I saw this change. It used to be the only blonde Chinese women you saw in Taiwan were prostitutes. And now it's, now what, right? I mean,
back to the 20 years ago.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. 20 years ago, only the prostitutes that were hanging around with the guys on Rest and Rec from Vietnam were dyeing their hair blonde, right? And no one else was. This has changed within the last, I would say, within the last 10 years. And it's come straight out of Japan. And so when you see, this is very peculiar, right? When you see Chinese people with their hair dyed blonde, for example, they're imitating, get ready, they're not imitating foreigners, they're not imitating Europeans, they're imitating Japanese.
Yeah, because it's a trend set in Japan, yeah.
Right, yeah. Right. I mean, this is, they're trying to look like a stylish Japanese person. They're not trying to look like a foreigner, per se. And so now how are you going to sell, your hair dye? Right? You can't sell your hair dye saying it will make you look like Catherine Deneuve.
No, right, because
they don't want to look like Catherine.
Exactly. This is the thing. I think a lot of people come over and they see these trends and they completely misinterpret them. So, like you're saying, these trends come from Japan, and maybe in Japan they're not even Western influence as much as they are like anime influence. So, I mean, these things, you really got to look deeper.
I think it's really, I think we've seen some really good points come out in today's, in this discussion. I think it's really nice the way we've really homed in on the whole product naming space. And when we've started to look at the idea of literal translation, meaning translation, the syllable by syllable, the sentence, the use of phrasing, it's really shows what a deep minefield this is, and how some examples that we've got on the web of or the pictures we've looked at have done such a really clever and original job, like the Coca-Cola approach, whereas others have not kind of succeeded in the same way, like the Skippy product, or even maybe like Quaker, but Quaker have managed to overcome it in rather an original, clever kind of way. So it really, I think, as I say, it's a really complex area. It's not one that a Western company can hope to go it alone with. And as Robert has really walked us through in this last fascinating discussion, I think it's really shown us how you've got to have some local insight, not only local insight, but really deep local insight.
Yeah, before we end this show, I want to introduce Stephen Huang, who joined us right in the middle of the show. So Stephen is from National Kaohsiung First University of Science and Technology, the Marketing and Logistics Department. And Stephen, we say hello and goodbye.
Yeah. I really enjoy the show today, and I have a suggestion. Maybe we can invite Robert again for the branding in mainland China.
Sounds interesting.
I think there are many differences between across the strait.
Yes.
For the branding.
Yeah, I think that's so.
Yeah, just between Taiwan and Hong Kong, so many differences Robert had mentioned.
Yes.
Okay, well, that will wrap it up today. We had an extra long show, but a really interesting one. And we hope to have Robert back in the future. So good show, guys, and see you next time. This is Talk of Asian Marketing with a special emphasis on localized Chinese consumer behavior. Meow, 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 meow